Access number 29047, Mr. Lentown End, Reel 12. Now, when you got back to Feltham, tell me what you were doing there.
Straight back on the same job. That was it. We'd fired one. I went back and still continued training.
Now, you did that, though, for a long time. Cause yeah. You were there until until October?
Yeah.
64.
Well, it was a mighty weapon.
Now, anything happened during that period? I mean, there must have been something happened in 4 years.
I know what you're saying, not really though. It's one of these things that the unit was there, it was working. We carried on doing the training, all the things. We improved the training things, and we just learnt a lot about it until all our crews were absolutely cracked crews. There's no argument about that. They were totally red hot.
You were very proud of the success of your training team.
Yeah, well, not just me. There were two or three other people helped.
But that altogether, the training team that was put together was very effective. You would say that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, most effective, yeah.
Now, were you very aware of the Cold War and the threat from Russia? Because you're there until 64. Yeah. There's things like...
Well, again, only in so much as it was there, you know. Nobody ever believed it was going to happen, but there again, it's...
Now, tell me about... Why didn't... I mean, because that includes... I'm not quite sure my history's dreadful. It includes the period when Kennedy and the Bay of Pigs and all this...
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And
you
were there during that. I mean,
oh, yeah.
They could have been fired.
Yeah, well, on the when the Bay of Pigs was on, every one of our missiles went to go.
Now, what do you mean by go?
They were all ready to lift off. They could have gone in about 10 minutes. We got to that state.
That's during the Cuba crisis.
Yeah.
And how seriously did you take it, or did you?
Oh, I was dead worried then. I said I'd got nothing to do. Everything went. I was at the launch control center, standing by. The rest of the crew were, and see every missile, everybody that was on it. There were no crews then. Everybody went. You know, the whole lot went. Every member of the launch crews. There weren't just one launch crew on. All the crews went out. At Mia's training flight with a couple of people. Our training, by this time, the training flight, we'd expanded it, so it was a lot bigger.
So how did you all feel? I mean, had you ever done this before, put them all to ready, ready to fire?
No, first time ever.
So what were you thinking?
Well, so my family were just 300 yards down the road, and if we'd have fired them, what would have come back? Because we're always told that they would have been firing back. Whether they would have not, I don't know. There's been a lot of myths about these sort of things. But definitely, I was worried, obviously. That was the only time.
Did you still think that they wouldn't be fired? Did you still think it was all a false alarm?
I don't know. It's kept a bit... I didn't know. I think it's really one of these things you hope it wasn't going to, you know. I bet these blokes that went on D-Day were on the Seine or on the boat going, oh, well, they'll send us back, you know. I hope they would. But
so you were very tense about it.
Oh, yeah.
What were people like? I mean, what was the atmosphere like at the launch control? You were at the launch control centre.
Well,
what was it like in there?
It's like any other. You've seen about the Brit ones, which you see, it's exactly the same. It's totally calm. This is what training does.
Now, what was in the launch control? Can you just describe for us the launch control?
It's very, very,
then,
very, 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 very difficult because what happens there is there's only one really big consul in there, and the wing commander that's in charge of it, and he had one or two other people with him then, was there in total control, total contact with all the crews, and he was there for that purpose. There was very little to say. It was announced when each missile had got to its ready state, and that was it.
Now, who made the final decision, this wing commander?
Well, oh, no, no. He gave the final decision there, yeah. But Mildenhall was the command centre. I mean, that was just like in the Battle of Britain, who made the final decision there, Churchill sort of thing. But where along, I don't know. Where the actual comes from, I don't know. But
were there any fail-safes to stop in case your wing commander went bonkers? I mean, you know...
Again... I can't really say there was. I mean, let's put it like this. If our wing commander went bonkers, he would do. I don't know. I just don't know. Oh, wait a minute. The only other one, almost forgotten. This poor lad. We had the American authentication officer. See, now he had to get the authentication from the American command before he would turn the war peace key. Mind you, it's a fact that he was on his own amongst all the Air Force blokes.
Couldn't have done much about it. He would turn the, what's the war peace key?
Well, you have a launch key that launches the missile. You know, it starts the sequence. Towards the end, just before you go, the warhead itself has to be armed. Right? And this is another key. That's basically what it is. And he had the key around his, had a little chain around his neck. His poor young lads just come all the way from America, young college lads. They must have been all national servicemen. They had a little 6 weeks training and sent them over towards them amongst those hairy limes. But so he got on all right.
There was nothing to stop you. I mean, there was no sort of complex code or anything you had to. So you could have just knocked him on the head and taken the key off him.
Yeah, well, they were aware of that too.
Now, so what happened that day? I mean, how did you know? When did the tension relax? When did you put the missiles up? Long did you keep the missiles up for?
Dear, no, I, to my utter shame, I can't tell you. I can't tell you. All I know is it was called off, and that was it. It was stand down.
But you don't remember how long?
I don't remember how long now.
How did you feel? What was your reaction?
Bloody relieved.
I mean, was there any celebrations or?
No, I don't think so. No, in fact, there wasn't. We're just all glad to go home.
But you felt relieved?
Yeah, almost definitely. Well, who wouldn't? We knew what these things could do, and we knew that we'd got 60 of them. We didn't know how many the other side had got.
Yes. Now, that was the only time they were ever prepared to fire? I mean, that 10 minutes
the off. Only time that they were up to the...
That meant they'd got the fuel in then, did it?
Yeah.
So they were actually right on the nose.
Yeah.
Now, how did that posting come to an end? It seems to have ended in October 64.
Well, these Americans, are we absolutely, totally honest, we'd got plans for another CTL, which Combat Training Launch exercise in the States, like the one I went on. There was another one was coming up. I was going to go on that, and I forget. Was it October? I'd say I finished there.
It seemed to say that, yeah. You went to Swanton Morley then.
Yeah, well, about December, I was supposed to go December out to the States again for another launch, and suddenly the Americans said, "No, that's it. So we don't need them anymore." So they'd got Atlas ready by then, so they took it over. They disbanded the Thor force just like that within a few days.
And the Americans made that decision, did they?
That's being specific, I would presume it was. I think it was. It must have been. It's the only reason that they would that we would abandon it if the Americans wanted it, but we didn't know that it was going to be abandoned until the last minute.
Do you know if they were taking on the Atlas system here in Britain?
No, there was no necessity. That was it would be a total waste of time. It'd been overkill because they can hit the States. The Atlas can hit it from where they from America. They had complete control, and they had in the. Being these more, what's the last one? Saturn, was it? There was another, even more. See, all these missiles are liquid fueled, which are highly volatile things. But the new solid rocket, solid fuel, that were totally underground and nobody knew where they were out in the Nevada desert. They were all came on there. How long after they came on? I don't know.
So there's just no need for anything in Britain because they could fire them just as quick from...
That's it. Well, apart from which, I mean, this is not fact, this is me. Once the Americans had got it, they didn't need us, which has happened before.
Were you sorry when they were disbanded? I mean, in the sense you'd been there a long time,
yeah.
Hadn't you?
Oh, I love football, yeah. Yeah, I was sorry in a way, but I went to the next one.
Now, your next posting is your last posting.
That's it.
Tell me what you're doing. You're chief technician again. What are you doing?
Well, again, at the end, when Thor closed down, we had the old thing that the Air Force had got all these blokes sculling around doing nothing, didn't know what they were going to do with them. So we, it must have been probably 6 weeks or probably more. Time this far ago, it's difficult to say. We went into a program of keeping the blokes in classrooms and things like this and teaching something. I had the idea, which was accepted readily, is that at that time all the ranks in the Air Force had to, they got this new idea that you had to have an administrative ability, you know, all the RAF rules and regulations, and I forget what it's called, before you can get promoted you had to have one of these checks, you see. Well, nobody had done it at all, so I set up a course to teach this and went on with that, which was nothing at all to do with Thor, it was just to keep them busy.
And that was still at Feltham?
I was still at Feltham. And then while I was at Feltham, there was an advert came on, standing orders that they wanted.
So that was an admin course?
Well, it was just a course. It was of administration details, but it was really nothing official. It was just keep them busy. It was either that, else they had to go out and do PT and running around a buried track.
So, what's your next posting?
Well, the next one is Swanton Morley, which, as I say, I volunteered Swanton Morley, who said they wanted people for research into RAF servicing procedures. Well, Swanton Morley was just up the roads. In fact, the first thing I volunteered for, because there's another one, is the flight refuelling at Marham. There was a flight refuelling squadron, but I didn't get that. I volunteered for that, was turned down. I volunteered with my mate. For the one at Swanton Morley, and we went over to there.
Now, this is the Central Servicing Development
Establishment.
That's it. I've never heard of that.
CSDE.
Now, what exactly is it? What's the role of the unit?
The role of the unit is to write the books to keep for the Air Force for servicing and develop servicing procedures. You know what NDT testing is, do you? Non-destructive testing. There is a non-destructive testing unit there that, in conjunction with industry, worked out all the procedures for checking faults in aircraft by not destroying them.
So how do you start with this? I mean, well, you're developing servicing procedures. How do you go about it?
Right, well, I wasn't on the non-destructive test. I was saying this, what sort of morning did. Well, basically, when it's a new aircraft, I did the VC-10 immediately. That was the one I went straight onto, the VC-10. When an aircraft is bought by the Air Force, the manufacturers have to provide facilities to train the Air Force. Now, the first thing that happens is this one guy goes, or one or two, depending on what the project is, goes, an Air Force bloke, usually probably an officer and a chief tech or sergeant, go to the aircraft manufacturers for, it's permanently stationed there, it's a good little number. And he's from CSDE, and in addition, he feeds back the information to CSDE about the servicing procedures that have got to be adopted on this aircraft. Let's put some lights on for you.
Okay.
Well, the servicing procedures, the CSDE were developing the correct servicing procedures as approved by the manufacturers in conjunction with the RAF as to what needs servicing at a regular basis on the aircraft, what needs at what periods certain components need to be changed. These are all in conjunction with the aircraft manufacturers. They have, each has to agree. So CSDE, I got the job of looking after the air conditioning equipment for the VC-10, which meant going down to the aircraft factories. They had meetings down there, which were repair and assessment meetings, as they called them. And from this, you develop the necessary procedures for starting. As soon as the aircraft went into service, there were a set of servicing manuals.
And would you actually write the manuals?
Yes, this was the job writing. This is where I went into technical writing fully.
And you seem to have done some other interesting aircraft. What were we doing on a TSR-2?
TSR-2, the same job, but TSR-2, sort of funny actually, TSR-2. All that I ever did on the TSR-2 was the parachute release gear. I was due to do more than it, but then they backed the scrap of TSR-2, so I didn't go on in it. But that was the first job I did. I did the release gear.
And what did you find out about it? Can you remember now?
Well, all you have to do, you have to find out, what you learn from the manufacturers. You go down to the manufacturers, and you give them the drawings, and you give them the facilities with the engineers that work on the job down there, the designers and the rest of it, just like any other technical author that have done since. And you write off about it, but you're not particularly interested in writing how it works. That's another department of the RAF. It's how you service them at CFD. That's what it is, Central Service.
So there's a parachute release on that. Now, there's other aircraft you mentioned, Vulcans. What were you doing for the Vulcans?
On the Vulcans, I did the undercarriages, the mighty undercarriages, how to take them apart, how to change the seals, when to change the seals, all the test procedures.
And the other thing, I don't recognise them as aircraft names, Blue Steel and Victors. I don't know what
they are. Blue Steel was a missile, the RAF missile.
So what were you doing for that?
Exactly the same, just the servicing procedures.
For the whole missile?
Yeah, that was not quite. That was a missile that was just carried underneath Victor V bombers.
And the Victors?
And the Victors is just one of the V bombers, one of the big V bombers. The Vulcan, the Victor, and the Varsity. Not the Varsity, the Valiant.
And what were you doing on there?
Well, exactly the same thing, writing the servicing procedures.
For any particular part of the
I think on the Victors, from what I can remember, I was doing the hydraulics.
So you weren't even particularly specialising on one thing. You've got a fair range there.
I was an aircraft fitter. I could do engines or airframes. That was my trade.
And anything, and then having produced this, you'd write the manuals?
Yeah. The servicing manuals. I've still got a couple of them at home here. The most interesting one I ever did was interesting, unusual, is that down at Exeter Airport, they had a couple of Meteors with target towing gear on it. And they found out that these were civil. They were civil people that were running this. It was a civil unit, all ex-RAF people. It was a civil unit down at Exeter Airport. And somebody along the line discovered they hadn't got servicing procedures, so I had to go down there and write that for them. Which, of course, a hell of a laugh, really, when you think, I'd go down there, I'd never even seen the flipping stuff. I'd tell him blokes who've been doing it for years had to do it. But of course you don't adopt that, you know this, you don't adopt that, you know, you go down there and find out what they know, and then you put it down on paper and you send it back to them and say, is that okay?
And was this for the whole of the Meteor, just for
for the target towing gear? God, the Meteor was so well in by this time, there were so many Meteors in the Air Force and all about it, but target towing gear was a different thing.
And nothing else you remember? You were obviously enjoying this work.
No, I think I was bored stiff with it, to tell you the truth.
Were you?
Yeah.
It sounds like you're enjoying it.
No, it's only writing. Nothing. You don't get your hands dirty. Because I wasn't the only one. Quite a number of people did. Got fed up with it. But it was an interesting experience.
Well, I misinterpreted you there. That's fair enough. Now, how did you come to finish? And unless there's anything else about Swanton Morley, I mean, that seems to cover that.
I don't think there really is.
So take me through your demob. How come you're demobbed? I mean, do you want to be, is that just the end of your time?
My wife said she'd had enough and wanted to come out, so I agreed with her and I came out.
So you volunteered to come out?
It was at the time when there were too many people in the Air Force and they were trying to get rid of them, so they offered you an incentive to come out, a cash incentive, so I took it.
And that's January 1966?
Yeah.
Now, how did you feel on leaving?
I cried literally. I hated the idea of leaving. I was moping about, totally lost or hopeless. Fortunately, I went to Pira, which
now tell me. So you came out. There's two. You were upset.
Yeah. Well, upset.
But the other thing is, how did you settle down to the civilian lifestyle?
It's very, very difficult. It's totally different. It's a totally different. The sort of difference that you get is at CSDE, where I was taught. I mean, when I was taught technical writing, I was taught technical writing. They had a school at CSDE that taught you how to write. The correct procedures is service writing is very specific.
This is when you were at
Swanton Morley, yeah. So when I came to Pira,
we're doing civilian lifestyle. I mean, what did you find unusual about civilian life then? What was it that you had trouble acclimatising to?
Well, there wasn't the mess life, and there wasn't anything of this nature. You know, there's not so much sports going on. It was just not the good, not the same social life. You had to work to it.
Were you sorry you'd left?
Yeah. Sorry I'd left until I was 65. No, 55, that's right, until I was 55.
Now tell me about the job you got. You're working as a technical writer.
I was technical writer. I was specific that specifically hired by PIRA to...
Who's PIRA? How do you spell that?
A Production Engineering Research Association.
And who are they?
Well, it's a research... It started out as a government department in Loughborough University, and it's one of these research associations that the government set up just after the war. There were PIRA and all sorts of other ones, but this was production engineering, literally production engineering only at this point. But the bloke that set it up, set up the technical authorship side of it, it was supposed to be originally just for the work that went on with PIRA, but he persuaded PIRA to allow it, him to go and get contracts outside that so that money could come in for doing this technical authorship. And he got the contract to write the technical manuals for the VC-10, the airline of the VC-10. And he...
The same one as you'd been doing before?
Oh, no, the VC... No, sorry, not the VC... Sorry, VC, not the VC-10. The BC-111, the airliner. Sorry, that was stuck in my mind wrong.
Now, so you were hired as you were going to be a technical writer,
yeah,
with them, Production Engineering Research Association. Yeah. And when did you start with them?
Start? Haven't they got a date in there?
Is it just when you left the RAF?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's right. Sorry. So
how long did you do that
for? It was 24 years.
So till 1980?
Yeah.
1990?
1966, actually.
So 1990.
Was it? Oh, yeah, well, no, I don't know. I came out in 1966, 25. Yeah, I did 24 years at PIRA. I also had the same amount of time in the Air Force as I had at PIRA.
Now, did you enjoy the work there?
I enjoyed the work, but I didn't like the job. I didn't like... We had some... I had a bad boss who was a paid idiot. Apart from that, I enjoyed the job. I really, really did enjoy it.
Are there any particular jobs you did that are military? I think you worked on some tanks, didn't you? Can you just tell them? Remember, they can't see.
You can't see.
They can't see.
Sorry.
So tell us what you did.
Well, I started out doing the BAC-111. Right, that was the all-purpose airliner. It was built at Heron Airport, at the ones I went on, and they sold quite a lot of these, and I did all the writing, strange enough, for the furnishings on it. each aircraft, depending on which company it goes to, has a different set of furnishings, and I wrote technical manuals for, you know, how to fit the furnishings and all of this sort of thing. I did a very small amount of that on hydraulics, but not a lot. I didn't do much of the hydraulics. Then suddenly, by a whim of PIRA, I couldn't work for them anymore, because it was PIRA, you had to be a member firm for them to work for you, and BAC wouldn't pay their fee, and so I had to stop working for them, which was a bit of a pity. So the next big one I went for, I went and did Vickers Tanks. And I did...
Now, what were you doing on Vickers Tanks?
Writing the technical manuals for all the tanks.
Which ones?
The Vickers Main Mark III battle tank, the Challenger.
What, does it have a nickname, the Mark III battle tank?
It was Mark III. It sold to all these African countries.
And what were you doing on that, the Vickers Mark III?
Everything. Everything on it except the engine, because the engine, of course, was a Rolls-Royce engine some of the time. But the engine was completely covered by the engine manufacturers.
And what was it like? What do you think of the Mark III? I mean, it's completely away from your normal...
Oh yeah, I knew nothing about tanks. Well, it's an engineering. It's all the same. You always get the same way. It wasn't too bad, wasn't it? But we didn't have them in the British Army, as far as I remember. I don't think there were any. They all the ones I was writing for were overseas, and it was, you know.
And what about the Challenger?
The Challenger. There's two Challengers, as you well know. There's the Challenger battle tank. But I did the Challenger ARV, which is the Armoured Recovery Vehicle, which is basically the chassis and the engine and all the main things on the Challenger are the same as the battle tank, but the gun turret and all this sort of stuff is replaced with a big winch, a crane, a bulldozer blade at the front. It's a recovery vehicle for recovering other tanks.
Any other things that might, military interest, or was that the main things?
So that was, they were the two mains. Oh, I did Brit Norman, of course. Forgot about that. Brit Norman Islander and Trilander. I did all of that.
I don't know what it is.
With Brit Norman Islander, it's a little twin engine plane built on the Isle of Wight. It's still being built, actually. And the Trilander, which was a version of it with three engines. I did them for a long while as well, the two of them together. In fact, I did them when I left Beira.
Now, so you were with them until 1990.
Yeah.
Now, the only other thing, and that was your career, basically. After.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing we want to ask you is you're a prominent member of the local RAF Association. We just want to ask you what that does for you, why you joined it, when you joined it, and what you got out of it.
I joined it fairly soon after I got out of the Air Force. And just as I progressed, I was been on the committee for many, many years. I was the chairman until April of this year, and now I'm the president.
Now, what does it do for you? What's good about the RAF Association?
Booze.
The club part, the club, bars, the club very important.
Yeah. Mind you, its prime objective is charity for the four ex-members of the RAF. That's our prime object.
And is it important to you that as a club or association?
It is, very much, yes. I spend a lot of time, or did.
Is there a problem with an aging membership? I mean, you yourself are now
most certainly
pushing on a bit, you know,
That's the biggest problem, right? So I haven't seen the latest figures, but not many years ago, only 4 or 5 years ago, that we had 100,000 membership, which is twice as big as the RAF is now. It's down to about 60 now. That's how fast it's falling. Simply because eight people like me.
So, is there a solution to that, do you think?
I personally don't think there is a solution, actually. I think it's just one of those things. See, the British Legion, all of these people have the same problem. The base that all of these people were built on and built up were wartime people. Well, they're all dying off now. The young lads now are not really interested in joining the RAF. Some of them, we get a couple, but not many of them. It's not jazzy enough. I mean, it's an old man's club now, sort of thing. there's no short skirts and all that sort of thing down there.
But you still enjoy going down there?
Oh, I still. Well, to my mind, my biggest enjoyment is, the first and foremost, I mean, Keith, you know, Keith, he's the secretary.
We've interviewed him, yeah.
Yeah. It's the only place you can go for a drink without trouble now. But that's not the only reason I put it first. You're just known there. It's a club that's friends all the time. He's always got friends down there.
Thank you very much.